Session number 12907, Anthony Bashford, Reel 5.
Now, if we can take it on from the Reichswehr, because you went through Germany to the Baltic, I think.
Yes, before then, as we'd finished the Reichswald, and after the clearing of the west bank of the Rhine, the 44th Royal Tank Regiment was then pulled back into Belgium under great secrecy. We left all our tanks behind in Germany, around Kleve somewhere. We put all our tanks in the field, left them, and came by lorry transport back into Belgium to somewhere near to the Maas River. And there we were told that we were going to be retrained within 7 days, 10 days, into amphibious Shermans to cross the Rhine. So we came back into that part of Belgium and spent 10 days learning to master these amphibious Shermans and learning to cross the River Maas, which was in full spate at that time, but which wasn't quite as wide as the Rhine was going to turn out to be. So we got on all right. Everybody was, familiar with floating Shermans. And then we set off to cross the Rhine. This must have been March, I suppose, March 45. So off we went, tanks trundling along. We were issued on the night march to the Rhine with our first self-heating tins of cocoa, which we hadn't had before. The self-heating tins of cocoa had a little element in the centre of the tin so that when you struck it with a match and fused it, it heated the contents so that you had a good tin. The only problem was that it overheated the hot contents and they became so scaldingly hot that you couldn't drink it for some time. But that was very welcome. And then the crossing of the Rhine started, I think, about 5 o'clock in the morning with crocodiles, and we followed the crocodiles across. The Rhine current was much as I think everybody expected. Our tank, unfortunately, had a battery flat, and we had to stay on this side until we got new batteries. Two Baker, that was the second or third tank in two troop. The canvas screen was hit by mortar fire and the Sherman sank. And unfortunately, Two Baker was carrying the troop ukulele that was a prized possession of the troop. And the troop ukulele was our last seen floating down the Rhine towards Rotterdam. But the crew escaped with their Mae West and got back to shore. So our tank by that time had got new batteries and we followed across. And we spent the next 3 days really in counter-defensive positions. That is, we didn't come across any great amount of German armour, lots of artillery and infantry. And then after that, it was a series, I remember, of leapfrogging through German defence lines. One was the German Marine unit, which had come down presumably from Kiel Way, that was rather difficult to get through. Then we ran up against the outer AKAC defence ring of Bremen, where the 88 guns, which were normally for AKAC duty, were simply turned down and levelled against the tanks, and that was rather difficult. And we came up around the outskirts of Bremen in a thick mist, and there was the dreaded apprehension that as the mist, you went through the mist, then an 88 would be looking at you before you had time to see where it was. But we got round Bremen and then went on to the outskirts of Hamburg, and I think it was going through Hamburg on about May the 3rd that one felt very sorry for the German civilian population. I don't think any of us had really thought that, the devastation of German cities was quite as bad as it had been. Of course, I don't think we knew much about the firestorm that Hamburg had had. So I think that was the first time that one rather felt terribly sorry for the German population. This, though, was balanced by the streams of refugees and displaced persons that were suddenly realizing that they could walk out of their labor camps and start to walk home. And they picked up little dog carts and ordinary carts and just started to walk home. Some went west, of course, back to France. But most of them were Poles. And they were dressed in this striped garb.
Were they actual concentration camp victims?
By that time they were mixed up, obviously. Some labour camp inmates had uniforms and some didn't. And we gave them all that we got. One of the funny parts about this is that the British Army rations, called compo rations, which was a box of rations that should last 7 men, 7 days, 14 men one day, or whatever combination it was, or 2 men, 7 days, they always had not only the surplus of toilet paper I mentioned, but always had a surplus of tinned sardines. So most Sherman tanks that you had spent any time in, that you hadn't lost or had replaced, invariably had a surplus collection of sardines. So all of these, of course, and other, any other rations, or all the other rations we had, we gave these people who were heading east. And then after a day on the outskirts of Hamburg, where there was absolutely no opposition whatsoever, and again it was largely an infantry operation to take control of the buildings, we then moved north of Hamburg up to Uetersen.
How do you spell that?
Uetersen. So that's going a bit up on the towards Denmark. At Uetersen, we came to rest, had our memorial service, and then after that we moved over to the Baltic to operate a dismemberment control unit. And by this time, of course, it was the middle of May, end of May, and there were probably 3 million German soldiers squatting in North Germany and up towards the Danish border, squatting and waiting. And our job was to screen them, and any German soldiers who lived in the American zone would be sent down to help with the forthcoming summer harvest. So we operated a disbandment control unit where every German was searched. All identifiable SS members were put on one side for interrogation and taken off the island of Sylt. And they were a sorry lot. But the weather was good. And in our off-duty days, we sat on the Baltic beach, a bit marred because in the final few days of the war, the German typhoons had unfortunately sunk 2 ships in Travemünde Bay that were full of displaced people.
And these were British or American?
No, these were displaced Poles or what have you.
But whose typhoons were they?
The Air Force, the RAF. The American Air Force wasn't operating up north then. So the grisly part of that was that as the ships slowly rocked, then their dead cargo would be discharged and washed up on the beach, so we had to have a burial party every day. So although the weather was nice, in fact the duty wasn't pleasant.
Were there many of these corpses that you had to deal with?
Yes.
Hundreds?
Tens, each morning. Eventually the Royal Engineers came and had a unit there where they disposed of them. So it wasn't really our function to do that. But then, of course, that was then June 1945, and the British Army was going to be demobbed, and men were getting ready to go home. And the 44th Royal Tank Regiment was then disbanded, being a territorial unit. And I was then seconded to the 3rd Royal Tank Regiment, but sent down on the staff of the College of the Rhine Army at Göttingen. And that was a very pleasant town, Göttingen, which only had one bomb on it, on this railway station. And the College of the Rhine Army was a 4-week course that any soldier could take before he went back to civilian life. It was either a practical course, like plumbing or bricklaying, or it could be an academic course. And the most popular was politics and economics. And one of the Star Warrant Officer lecturers was a fellow called Mendelssohn, who became MP for Leeds. So the College of the Rhine Army was what we call a cushy billet. And being in the on the permanent staff, you had an intake of about 600 soldiers every 4 weeks, and a week's rest, and then another intake of 600 soldiers. And my duty was to look after the PRI stores, or the Nephi ration, as it was called. So that was a very pleasant change from more military duties.
Did you attend any of the lectures yourself?
No.
Or have any contact with Mr. Mendelssohn?
Not directly, no.
What was the kind of mood of the army at that time, from what you could see?
Well, obviously, it was an hour-to-hour, day-to-day monitoring of the DMOB number group. Every soldier had a DMOB number or group, and these groups were released. So that every week, one or more of the permanent staff would disappear back to the UK. The people who came on the course were obviously taking a cushy 4 weeks, because the food in the at the course was very, very good, and the barrack accommodation was very good. So a lot of them who came were really taking a nice 4 weeks before they went back to civilian life from the drudgery of their own units. Some applied themselves diligently, obviously, and some just were passing the time until they could go home. But there was a very pleasant 18 months in Göttingen.
Were people very political at that time?
They were political because the general election had returned a socialist government. The general election had happened, I think, in May 45, when I was still up at Uetersen. And there had been a very, very active political campaign within the regiment in terms of debate. But the majority of the rank and file were left-wing because of the impact of the Beveridge Report during the war and the impact of the Army Bureau of Current Affairs lectures. So, and because the people were, I suppose, from a democracy and not from an autocratic state, they discussed these issues. And the rank and file generally wanted a change of direction in the country's affairs. And I think it was the rank and file of the services that really brought the socialist government in. And that carried on, obviously, after the general election. The general idea was that if you went back home, and of course a lot of those people had been away for 6 years, long time. But anybody been away for 6 years or 5 years or 4 years, I'd rather assume that if you'd won the war, that things needed and ought to be different at home. So there was a great expectation that the social conditions would change at home, which indeed they started to do.
Who was conducting the political campaigning in 44 RTR in Uetersen?
That was engendered within the squadron, that is, before, and I was very miffed, of course, because I couldn't vote. I was only 19 and not allowed to vote, and I was very miffed at this, that myself and maybe only two others who were as young as that were not allowed to vote. We thought that was a bit unfair. But it was engendered within the squadron, and it was just a debate. I mean, not all the rank and file were left-wing. We had vehement right-wingers. No, not vehement right-wingers. Strong conservatives in the rank and file. So it wasn't just one, wasn't one-sided. There was just as almost as many quite vehement, conservative-minded other ranks as there were socialist-minded other ranks. So the debate was usually at the squadron level.
Who did you want to vote for yourself?
Oh, for the socialist government. Not because one felt that Winston Churchill had obviously led us through, and that he was the only one who could have done it. And, you know, he was the great man of his day. But I think it was the rest. And my parents had been working class. And in general, the whole feeling was that the social structure in England had been too ossified for too long. And also, I think naively, we believed that nationalisation was going to be the cure of all of the country's material wrongdoings. In fact, you know, it hasn't necessarily been the answer, although I think it helped to change things enormously. So we had a very spirited debate at the time, but of course, generally, everybody was pleased that Clement Attlee had got in.
I think you were telling me earlier off the record, if you don't mind me mentioning it, that you joined a Servicemen's Anti-War.
Oh, the ex-Servicemen's Anti-War group, yes. Well, yes, when I came back home, it wasn't quite home because my father moved out of London by then. The ex-Servicemen's Anti-War group was rather against the... Churchill by that time, of course, was... saying quite rightly about the Iron Curtain, but we couldn't quite see why we had to maintain such a large military strength. And the ex-Servicemen's Anti-War group was campaigning to reduce the army and the services much quicker and to reduce the military strength much quicker. In actual fact, I only went, I think, to maybe four or five meetings in London, because it was really... I think a front of the Communist Party, and they then were really extolling the virtues of the communist system rather than what I think we were trying to say we wanted in England. So as far as I know, ESORG didn't really last very long. It might have lasted for a year or so and faded away.
It was called the Ex-Servicemen's Anti-War
Group. ESORG.
How did you hear about it?
Oh, it must have been in one of the left-wing periodicals at the time, possibly.
Did you read left-wing periodicals?
Yes. Well, and also the Daily Herald was running strongly in those days.
What left-wing periodicals would you read apart from the Daily Herald?
Tribune, possibly.
Do you remember any individuals who played a prominent part in ESOL?
No, I can't. No, I had such a really fleeting...
Where did they meet?
In London, in the Quakers Hall. No, not Quakers Hall.
Near Euston?
Near Euston,
Just across the road from Euston Road?
That's right, yes. Mm.
Could I ask you...
There was a very strong anti-war feeling. I mean, amongst all of those who I think had spent some time in the army. So really it was anti-war rather than being... It wasn't political so much as just being anti-war and anti-militaristic.
What type of activities were they supposed to carry out?
Oh, lobbying, obviously. I think lobbying of members of parliament, getting speakers in to... it really is quite a strong pacifist element in it as well.
Did you feel that things did turn out after the war in view of the high expectations which you said you and your comrades had?
That it didn't come about quite as quickly. It came about slowly, didn't it? I mean, it wasn't until one had got into the late 60s that one felt any material. The other thing was that when I came out at the age of 22, I really had to start again. I had no civilian training. I had no qualifications. I got my O-levels. But you had to then start to build your career. And the age of 22, that's, you know, 4 years later than it might have been, I suppose. So you had to sort of buckle down a bit. So one got rather involved with evening class studies. There was no day release in those days, evening class studies. And catching up on social activities like tennis and... rambling and other things. But I think that the change came about too slowly for it to be immediately perceptible. The change in material well-being came about partly because one worked and got on, and partly because the social structure was changing and security benefits were better and unemployment benefit was more secure. So it came about slowly.
Mm-hmm. Could I ask you about the German civilians in Germany, if you had much personal contact with them?
Well, yes, quite a bit. They were friendly in a surprising way, but partly friendly because we had things they didn't have, and one met them through the black market activities, although that was frowned upon. The black market activities was quite a bit of the soldiers' social life, of bargaining 20 cigarettes for some material goods. Most of them were quite pleasant, the Germans, and on that lowly level, I suppose, of being a soldier and a civilian, you find more common ground against your rulers who have led you into war. But I did find, and of course one never ever met a member of the Nazi Party. Every German civilian had never been a member of the German Party, but always knew somebody who had. So one took this with a pinch of salt. We know that most of the German population supported the Nazi Party. But after the war, you never met a German who'd been anywhere near the Nazi Party. They were making the best of a bad job. They were struggling to survive, to get enough food and fat. So they were quite pleasant.
What type of things would you bargain with them?
Oh, they had access to cameras, particular cameras, optical things, binoculars. So we had cigarettes and chocolate.
Did you take any notice of the non-fraternisation order that came out?
Very little.
Was anybody punished for it?
Yes, some were, but I think so, but I don't know of anybody. That was a non-goer from the start. Yes, when the fraternisation ban came in, it seemed to be a logical thing, but in actual fact, I think overall there was too much sympathy for the German population for it to have worked. So it soon got rescinded.
Who did you blame for the war?
Oh, the Germans. As a whole, the Germans as a whole, as a race, one blamed, but I think when you got to know them, you felt, well, they weren't a lot different from anybody else, except they've got this peculiar habit of being led astray, if that's the right expression.
Could I ask you one general question about memories of war? Some people have sometimes said to me that you tend to remember the good things.
The brighter ones, yes.
You tend to cast a rosy hue and you don't remember things like how frightened you were and so on. Do you think there's any truth in that, as far as your own memory goes? Or?
Oh, yes, because the recollection is more of, is as much of the relationship between you and these other four men that you've never met before. So you've never met these men, they're different ages, different backgrounds. And if you get a good tank crew, then you do get a very intense understanding. I wouldn't say intense relationship, because that's got the wrong connotation. You get an intense understanding of this other man. And most of them were very simple in their... None of them wanted to be there. I mean, most of them were conscripted. I mean, it wasn't their choice to be in the army. But they'd been there 3, 4, or 5 years. And they would talk of their people at home. And there was a lot of humour. In fact, I don't remember any period of being out of tune with these men. You never quarrelled, there's no point of quarrelling. Everything was shared to the absolute basic level. You did share your cigarettes, you helped each other, and you knew that they weren't going to let you down at any time. And we had some, well, there are some very nice lads there. But of course, come the end of the war, they all wanted to go home.